Russian oil, we have to take a bit of a view backwards to, you know, the first time that oil was used as a weapon in 1973. And from that time onwards, India has been aware that because she has no access to oil, we have to get and plan access to our own oil in our own way. So actually all this came to a head in 1998, when you remember that Saudi Arabia decided that she would give oil to Pakistan at lower than normal rates. And India realized that we had to do it on our own. And that's the time when we started investing in oil all over the world. And we have investments in Russia. And because of those investments, we are now have access to cheaper Russian oil, and as a result have been able to get over this oil shock that when the oil giants raised their prices, India was able to prevent these prices being raised in India because they had access to cheaper Russian oil. So it does matter eventually, but India has been able to use this crisis to stand up on her own.
Lieutenant, in light of the increasing demand for Indian refined fuel in Europe, how do you see India's role in shaping the global oil market, and what challenges and opportunities lie ahead for the South Asian country?
Yeah, you know, you asked about India emerging as a alternative or as a global refining power, because we have access to how this world market moves now is like this, that India has access to cheaper Russian oil. That cheaper Russian oil is brought into India and refined. We are one of the world's largest refiners of oil. I think second or third in the world. And with that ability to refine oil, India has been able to utilize this cheaper Russian oil, refine it, and resell it to the European market at a higher price. And that has helped the Indian economy. As you know, the Indian population has become the largest in the world. We are a young population. We are growing very, very strongly. We need access to more money. We are developing our infrastructure. So all that requires money. And this ability of India to get this cheaper Russian oil, refine it in India, and resell it at a higher price shall certainly help the Indian economy. Along with this help to the Indian economy, since oil and economics has always been on the world stage as a geopolitical weapon, I would say this is the first time that India is realizing that we have to increase our ability, improve our economy, if we are to have a say in the geopolitics of the world.
Lieutenant, the European Union has put a ban on Russian oil imports. So how has this changed the global oil trade?
You know, Ali Reza, I must take our mind back to the global crisis about the Europe's to the Europe's decision to ban Russian oil. So what exactly happened was that when Europe followed the American lead to ban Russian oil, she went through a crisis of the availability of oil and the availability of expensive oil for her citizens. Europe, as you know, is not a growing market anymore. Economically, she is suffering. And this Russia-Ukraine war couldn't have come at a worse time for the European economy. The Indian ability to get cheaper Russian oil came from an ability that we had made a number of excellent financial decisions to invest in the Russian oil infrastructure from 2002 onwards. And because of that, India was able to get Russian oil at almost $10 less than the rest of the world.
Last but not least, how do you see the future of energy trade between Russia, India and Europe? And what factors are likely to shape this trade in the coming years?
That's a very interesting question about the future of the economic trade or the oil trade between India and Russia and how it is affecting Europe's economy. I feel that over the next 2 to 5 years, this will continue. The reason being that I don't think the Russian-Ukraine war is going to end. I don't think that the Americans will lift their sanctions on Russia. And as a result of it, Russia will continue to have to depend upon our friends like India to pick up her oil, give her money, and also help her sell her oil to the world, her natural resource. But why do I say only 2 to 5 years? The issue is that over the next decade, the world will move away from the use of fossil fuels, especially to power their transportation. There are, as you know, great strides being taken in the batteries that are being used now to power the transportation all across the world. As the batteries become better and as they have the capability to have more power and to keep that power for a longer period of time, and they become cheaper to use than fossil fuels, the world will automatically shift to the EV kind of vehicles or to any other technology that is available as a domestic resource.
There you have it, strategic expert Lieutenant General Shaukin Chauhan from India. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Ben Orton tweeted, "The EU sanctioned Russia and boycotted its oil, yet is still buying it indirectly from India at a higher price. This is ironically fueling both de-dollarization and inflation in the Eurozone, where workers' real wages dropped 6.5% from 2020 to 2022. S.L. Canton wrote, "Are these two facts related? India is importing record amounts of oil from Russia. India is exporting record amounts of fuel and diesel to Europe. The irrational U.S. and EU sanctions." Norbert Elikis says, "India is importing crude from Russia and selling to Europe. Guess who's being benefited? India has now become one of the largest suppliers of refined fuel to Europe. Also imported record crude oil from Russia."
And that was our episode about the Indo-US relations and Russian oil finding its way to Europe via India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are focusing on the first sermon where Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks about various issues, including the oneness of God, the creation. But one of the most important, one of the important discussions that he has there is with regards to the duties of the prophets. And we mentioned various responsibilities and duties that the messengers had. And amongst them was the one which we quoted in the previous session, where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَيُثِيرُ لَهُمْ دَفَائِنُ الْعُقُولِ, that one of the duties of the messengers is that they stir, or they cause to come forth, they extract or they bring forth those things that are buried. What things? What are these buried things? These are the intellectual processes. The intellects of the people have been buried. So what the messengers come and they do is that they extract them, they bring them forth, they excavate them so that they can be actually used by the people once more.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, you see, it is a sad reality, but it is true that there has always been a struggle by the enemies of the truth to make sure that the intellects of the people and their intellectual processes are limited. And throughout history, this was done in different ways. So sometimes opportunity was not given to people to study at all. Certain types of lessons were restricted to a certain group, a certain class, a certain caste of people, especially the ruling class, those that wished to control the resources of the people. And this was a reality, and if you read the Persian and Roman histories, you will realize that in the olden times when the kings wanted to control the people, that is the strategy that they used. And this is something repeated. Even today we see the same. But today the methods are more complicated. They are more refined. And that means that the people are given the opportunity to study and to seek knowledge and to do research. But then what information is given to them and the type of knowledge they have access to is fraudulent, is problematic, is mixed with falsehood. If you look at the way scientific research is done, as an example, the idea of there being a power above all of these material powers is completely negated. If you look at the research that is done in philosophy, today you've got philosophies that deny the actual existence in the external realm, which is an absurd idea, but yet these ideas are being fed into the minds of the people. You look at psychology, you've got extremely wicked and you can say wicked and weird ideas about, for example, human sexuality, about human gender, about human processes of thinking. You look at epistemology and the theory of knowledge. You see a vast amount of extremely absurd statements being placed in a very intellectual manner so that people feel that, this is something, there is something here. Research, quotes, and so many other things. But you can see that it is no value. And today we can see the results of these ideas, that the moral fabric of parts of the Western world is completely deteriorating. This is a sign that these types of theories and these types of knowledges have problem. And unfortunately, the general mass of people is being guided towards these directions and these forms of knowledge.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, the Prophet's duty is to extract the intellects and bring them forth once more to surface. And this is very important because the enemies of humanity, they wish to completely always keep these intellects of the people under the rubble. They want it to stay there. And what is the rubble and what is that, you can say, thing that they use to cover or bury the intellect? Are all these are all these false ideas that you see. Hedonism, nepotism, fascism and Nazism. You go into politics, a huge, vast array of different types of theories there to manipulate the way people think. So the thought processes of the people are becoming sick. If you look at the movies and what the movies portray today, okay, you see the same thing. You see now slowly the LGBTQ movements are becoming more and more, they seem to people, they are trying to portray to people these are natural things. While they are not natural. If you look at the previews or the reviews of those movies that propagate such ideas, those reviews are very high. But when you look at the intellectual content of those serials or those movies, they are literally repetitive and very, very boring. I mean, a time has come that the movie industry of the Western world, which includes the Hollywood, is going towards a serious boredom crisis because of the repetitive stories that are going on. And this is a problem that the Western world is facing today. There is a crisis that we need to look into clearly. And unfortunately, this type of attitude is what is causing the people's intellects in the world to kind of remain under the rubble. And it is time for a prophetic movement to reignite and rediscover the hidden intellects within this rubble. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio. قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and He's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab, and today we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Naqvi, who is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, dear listeners, in this program, we try to answer your curious questions that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today we're going to discuss a very sensitive issue, and that is, how do we keep our children safe from sexual abuse? So, Professor, recently I just have been scrolling down through social media, and I found this teenage girl who was going to a tutor to learn math, and while teaching, he was making some... His behavior was not a normal one. He was abusing her physically. So how do we teach our children actually to confront this kind of behavior, especially teens or especially girls who are very shy to say anything when they face such situations?
Yes, thank you very much. It's a very sensitive issue, as you mentioned. And we need to, more than teach our children, we need to be more careful ourselves also. Because it's a very sensitive, as you said, issue, which has a great effect and bearing upon the society as a whole, and on this particular family, which is which has to bear such issues and face and confront such situations where such abuse takes place. Unfortunately, it becomes a taboo or a bad omen for many. So the first thing is that we should be very much on our guards when we have children of a young age who cannot themselves manage themselves in such situations.
Okay.
So basically, though they may be of a little age, which is not they're not capable of taking care of themselves, we need to tell them how to manage their affairs in a way that is somehow, you know, they can at least relate to your to you what is happening, and you are in the you are aware of what's going on in their lives, and they are asked by you to relate to you anything which happens in their school or outside the house. They should be free with you. They should have this confidence that they can share with you.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be able to create that atmosphere where they confide in you. So if there is any unwarranted thing taking place, you can, you know, nip it in the bud.
Right.
And you can manage it at the beginning of such a situation, because, and for that you need to be extra careful. You need to work on your relationship with the child,
so that your child develops a trust on you and shares things with you. Well, Professor, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Naqvi, and we're discussing how to keep our children safe from sexual abuse. Professor, you said that the first thing parents need to do is to develop a level of confidence and trust in children that they share all the incidents that are happening to them in this society. But there are some kids who feel a gap, kind of like that. They have that gap of modesty with their parents and they are not able to share. So when we as parents leave that, we make everything, we keep them free sharing anything, don't you think that modesty gets away, or we have to balance the things?
So we need to, as a general rule, we need to develop that relationship where you talk about these issues in a modest way. You refer to these issues, and it makes you make it a habit in your home that you talk about modesty, you talk about being afif, talking about the hijab, being taking care of your eyes, eyesight, looking here and there, how you look, what you looked at, what you see, what you hear. If you have inculcated in your child a sense of precaution,
control.
And control,
yeah,
over one's actions, he feels that he can understand if something is out of the norm happening. If he is fine-tuned to such an extent where he knows that what is normal behavior and what is abnormal behavior, if he has that sense, that sense is developed. For example, I mean, nowadays, you can a child knows he cannot go and poke his finger into something which is like an electric socket or what. He's careful about that. He knows that it's going to endanger him. It's a dangerous thing. So it's not normal behavior. So a child realizes what normal behavior is through the environment that is created in the house. People, yeah. Everybody knows what the rules are, what things have to be taken. He knows sharp knives will hurt him.
Yeah.
So he shouldn't be handling it, or he should be handling it with care.
Yeah.
I mean, when you, for example, when your child sees you, that whenever you are washing your dishes and you're washing your forks and knives, when you put it in the place, you put it in such a way that the pointed edge is not facing upwards, that it doesn't hurt you.
All right.
And he realizes this is normal behavior. This is something which is going to keep you safe.
Okay.
So in the same sense, when you're talking about your behavior with others, especially the other sex, he knows what normal behavior is. This is normal to be modest. It is to be separated. Not gazing at one other, or not taking a very, a special kind of look, or touching, or whatever is not normal.
Yeah.
So you've inculcated that. You have given that understanding to him that any such behavior is abnormal, which is going to jeopardize his safety. Then he would be careful.
Yeah.
In a very, in a manner which is not direct. He knows she knows what normal
that
behavior
will get developed into him.
So if that happens, and number two, then you need to make them talk to them regularly, daily, as we've been saying all along, that whatever the child does outside the house, at school, or anywhere he goes or she goes,
he shares things with you.
He shares with you, and when he comes back, you sit down together and you talk about the daily things.
Yeah, we will discuss more with you after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, a man once came to the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam and said, I have never kissed a child. When he left, the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, this is someone who, in my view, is one of the people of hell.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Salman Naqvi with us in the studio. And Professor, you were saying that it's parents have to develop that environment wherein a child goes out to school or anywhere else and he comes back and discusses, gives a summary of where he was and what he felt like.
Yes, so That will happen when you have been able to pose that confidence in him. By sharing you have been able to repose your confidence in him or her by sharing your feelings and thoughts and what you've been doing the whole day. In the evening, you get together. In the afternoon, you get together. And you talk about what's happened all the day with you as a parent or as a member of society or at your place of work, and you share with them, with your family as a whole, and with the children as particularly what you've been doing all day long. Then they will, of course, relate what they've been doing. So you have to
make it like a conversation kind of thing. They should not be feeling that you're questioning them. You're saying even parents should share where they were, how was their day, and then they should be asking their children. It should not be like a questionnaire session that they feel unsafe or they feel kind of they are being questioned or integrated.
Exactly. And then what is important is that you should know who your child is dealing with, who the people, who the he's in touch with, she's in touch with at school, who the teachers are, who the classmates are.
Yeah.
And a father, a parent, or mother should know what type of friends he or she has.
Okay.
So this is very important that we are able to keep a track of what's happening in the environment outside home. And you should be also, if you, for example, place your trust in someone to take care of your child even at home, then you know whom you're reposing your trust in. A child caretaker maybe comes to your house also, and you need someone to take care of your kid when you're out, then you know whom you're giving that important duty to do, to whom you are giving that duty. You should be very careful in choosing that person. Even the school which you're choosing, what type of society are they from? The people who live, the students who are coming to that school, what type of society is it? Is it of a education, of an educated background?
What is the background of the society?
Yes.
Okay.
So that is important for children. You can't choose any school. You can't choose any type of teachers or mentors or whatever. You need to be careful in that. Of course, again, in the best of people, you find a person who may be a black sheep. Or sometimes very good people, they sometimes fall into the trap and they have their weak moments. And there can be an unfortunate happening in that situation also.
And that's now a difficult situation wherein more precautions are to be taken care of. And we'll discuss that with you in another episode, inshallah. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much for discussing all those sensitive and important issues with us. So dear listeners, in case you have any questions, queries, or you want to give us your feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also listen to our sessions again in our archive of programs, which is uploaded on our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab COI, Call of Islam, and you'll find an archive of our programs there, Islamic Upbringing. In case you want to listen to the short clips from our programs, you can go to social media platforms and search Call of Islam and find our programs there. Thank you so much for being with us. Stay safe until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Economic divide.
The U.S. debt ceiling has turned into a crisis again. This could be a partisan issue, which most likely it is. But at the same time, what is the U.S. doing when it comes to bringing this to the last minute and pushing the envelope? That's going to be the topic of this edition of the program. Coming up in today's program, these are some of the highlights that we'll be covering. First, when it comes to the U.S. debt ceiling and how that is panning out. Well, it's a bipartisan issue. We're going to explore that. Government shutdown is one of the consequences that may happen, and that, as a result, would be a risk to all Americans. Okay, so that's how serious this is when it comes to the debt ceiling. Now, there have been, when it comes to debt ceiling, there have been previous debt ceiling increases in the U.S. on multiple occasions. However, this time around, we're looking at $31.4 trillion for the year 2023. A quick question that comes about here, which we'll explore, is payback even possible? Then we'll take a look at the actual debt. The U.S. national debt is an epic figure. And by some accounts, even military personnel have said it's a threat to U.S. national security. And it risks a default. Will that happen?
House of Representatives has passed a bill that would boost the U.S.'s $31.4 trillion Fed debt ceiling in exchange for slashing government spending, including programs championed by the Democratic President Joe Biden, passed by a party-line vote of 217 to 215, with four Republicans breaking ranks. The bill now heads to the Democrat-controlled Senate, where it stands little chance of passing. Biden has already threatened to veto the bill, which includes spending cuts that he previously called irresponsible.
We've done our job. I've sat down with the president on February 1st. He ignored the rest of the time. He treats it just like the border. He wants to ignore it and thinks it goes away. That doesn't work in America. He's putting the American economy in jeopardy by his lack of action. Now he should sit down and negotiate. We passed this early. We are in April, way ahead of the debt limit. We are the only party to take fiscal action in a sound mind that would lift the debt limit so we wouldn't have economic damage.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the failure by Congress to raise the government's debt ceiling and the resulting default would trigger an economic catastrophe. The debt ceiling, also known as the debt limit, is the amount the U.S. can legally borrow to fulfill its financial obligations. When it comes to the U.S. national debt, the debt ceiling has been increased multiple times, the most recent one to have been risen to $31.4 trillion in December 2021. A failure to raise the limit would see the U.S. default. Lifting the debt ceiling was once a fairly routine vote. Since 1960, Congress has raised the ceiling 78 times, 49 times under Republican presidents, and 29 times under Democratic presidents. The debt ceiling was last raised in 2021 to $31.4 trillion, where it currently stands. Big increases in recent years have come not only from spending to combat COVID-19 and on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also to cover the rising medical costs of an aging population and to fund all other services that government provides. The U.S. national debt has reached such epic proportions that it is said to be the biggest threat to U.S. national security. At the same time, one of the biggest U.S. spending is on its military, which is more than the next nine top spending countries combined. Financial markets are growing increasingly concerned about the standoff, sending the cost of insuring exposure to U.S. debt to its highest level in a decade, with financial analysts warning about the increasing risk of a default. It's time now for the social media post on this program. There was a lot of bickering when it came on this topic, taking a look at the posts that we were perusing through. Anyways, first up, as total debt surpasses $31.4 trillion,
the current statutory limit, the Treasury is undertaking a series of bookkeeping maneuvers to disguise new borrowing and to keep the government operating. Next, this person said, I can't believe I'm writing this, but the U.S. Treasury will be in the market borrowing $207 billion today, of which it listed some items like $60 billion of 44-day cash management bills or $70 billion of four-week T-bills. Obviously, a lot of borrowing going on there, taking a look at this list. We then go to a website, the fake fight over the debt ceiling was the title. The debt ceiling forces us to talk about the proper role of government, but nobody wants to do that. We figure we'll break this down further. Democrats, of course, are not even pretending to rein in government and simply propose new spending. And then it says that's a big problem because our $31 trillion national debt has reached unprecedented levels and does need to be limited and then reduced. Next, we go to this post where it says the debt ceiling, America's budget crisis of its own creation. The dispute over U.S. national debt is not one of economics, but of gridlocked partisan politics. All right, those were some of the social media posts there. Let me introduce our guest for this first segment of our Q&A. First, we're going to bring in Martin Safe. He's a former managing editor and at International Affairs and a former chief news analyst at United Press International. Martin Safe, welcome to Economic Divide. This is a common scenario when it comes to the debt ceiling and the showdown that basically it seems like it's a showdown between the parties. Republicans have refused to increase the U.S. debt ceiling, and that's a limit on the amount of money Washington can borrow. And you need, obviously, to have the U.S. president consent to the large spending cuts, which obviously he has so far rejected. But then at the end, you always get this increase one way or another. At least that's what history has proven. Why does the U.S. find itself in this position time and again?
I think the ultimate reason, unfortunately, is that we have a 1789 constitution, a constitution that is now almost a quarter of a millennium old, and we have not adapted it for the 21st century. And in American society today, that atmosphere of bipartisanship and statesmanship is breaking down. And that is the real problem. It is breaking down. You have to have cooperation to make the system work. And the cooperation is not there, certainly on the Republican side at the moment.
Okay, let's bring in now Richard Black. Richard Black is the former state senator of Virginia, and he's also a Republican politician. Richard Black, welcome to Economic Divide. You know, taking a look at this debt ceiling, I don't want to say debacle, but it really should be very simple. You have a budget that gets passed, voted on, and if you go, you have to act and spend according to that budget. But time and again, the U.S. President or its administration goes beyond that or reaches that limit. It sounds like there's not only oversight, but obviously there is, but by design, it's moving forward that way. What if the U.S. can't pay this huge debt of over $31 trillion? And what would be the impact on the U.S. economy?
Well, it's a very difficult issue. There really are two primary points. One is that the United States dollar is the world's reserve currency. Because so much of the world's trade is settled in dollars, it makes it somewhat of an essential currency, at least for the time being. It may not retain that status, but as long as it does, the United States can literally create $1 trillion out of thin air. Now, that can only go on for so long, but it may still be quite a while before that ends. Now, the other part of the question you asked deals with, you know, does it ever reach a point where it simply can't be paid? The more that you accumulate debt without having real production to back it up, the more seductive this becomes. And you see this constant ratcheting up and increase in debt. And right now the debt is very, very high. And that exposes us to risks of inflation. And it also puts pressure on the world's economy.
time now for the MFA News section of the program. As usual, we have picked four topics for you with an economic flavor. First up, we take a look at UK's economy. We've taken a look at UK's economy quite a bit in the past 6 months. But this one, we had to bring to you because it's quite unbelievable. This is what the Bank of England has said, which is quite harsh, the message that it had for the Brits. It said that Britons need to accept that they are poorer. That's what they have said. This is while UK's finance minister has said this was a very difficult period, as prices of items like milk, sugar, and olive oil were around 40% higher than a year ago.
We understand the pressure that everyone is facing as a result of the increase in food prices, for example, that we see today. But the one thing they would not want us to do is to take a decision on pay that means that we entrench high inflation and we're still having these same bitter arguments in a year's time.
Next up, Russia-Iran de-dollarization. The next topic is just that, something we focused on quite a bit. Again, some of these news items need to be reintroduced in order to see what's going on with the latest. Here, Iran and Russia, they're taking the last steps toward integrating their economic banking systems. Iran's Shatab and Russia's Mir networks, these are the financial payment systems, they have started their joint financial activities on a trial basis. Really looking forward to seeing how that is going to pan out. All right, sanctions is up next in terms of anti-Russia sanctions that the West has executed against Russia. The Russian finance minister has said that these Western sanctions, they have actually boomeranged. That is said quite a bit when it comes to sanctions. And, of course, Russia and Iran have been at the receiving end. They use short-sighted policy. It's hurting the bloc more than Moscow. And he went on to say Western restrictions have diminished global confidence in the U.S. dollar and also the euro, adding, when Western countries introduce new packages of restrictions, we take anti-sanctions measures, and we see that we are succeeding. Finally, look at Israel's economy and see how they're doing with the protests that are still going strong after, lost count here. I think it's 4 months now that people there in the occupied territories are coming out and protesting against Netanyahu and his so-called judicial reforms. Moody's credit rating agency has cut Israel's sovereign credit rating, lowering Israel's outlook too stable from positive. It said the planned reforms could weaken Israel's institutions. The Israeli finance minister, however, had another take on it.
All right,
those were the topics that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section is upon us. The U.S. government has hit its $31.4 trillion debt ceiling. That has triggered fears of a nasty fallout for Americans. Well, here are some of the facts in this in-depth section behind the debt ceiling crisis. First up, as the national debt has soared, the U.S. Treasury Department has had to borrow more money to pay for government spending. That's the definition of it. The legislative curb on this borrowing is known as the debt ceiling. National debt soaring is another way of describing government spending. Then we move on to what the Treasury Department does in terms of spending. Well, it spends the maximum amount authorized under the ceiling, but Congress must decide to suspend or to raise the limit on borrowing. All right. Now, here's a look at how, irrespective of who's been in the White House, the U.S. debt has increased dramatically as you progress from the year 1981 all the way through the year 2022. No matter who's been in office, the debt ceiling has increased. Let's move on to the next total national debt. And the debt ceiling, we've mentioned this figure before, September 2021, where the debt went, where it was at $28.5 trillion. It went all the way up to almost $31.5 trillion, which is where we stand. And that is where, obviously, the U.S. public debt is subject to its limit. All right, the next graph, Moody's analysis, is what we're going to look at, which said that GOP spending cuts and a debt ceiling increase and the repercussions of it. Well, 2.6 million jobs, okay, that's a lot. Loss per day, $300 million. GDP loss, 0.3% of the U.S.'s GDP. Layoffs, now these are federal work layoffs, federal workers, 1 million, okay? And then you have one of the most important ones that could be impacted or will be impacted, and that's military staff salaries that are not going to get paid, and obviously that's going to affect the U.S.'s security, okay? So how serious of an issue this is. Then we move on to how the U.S. government has run a deficit. This is important because, again, why do they keep going above what they have to spend? How much money are we talking about? It's $1 trillion on average that the government spends more based on the budget that they pass. It's not just a matter of $100 million or $50 million, $1 trillion more. And obviously that's something that has been going on, but some say it's not sustainable, and it means that they spend more money than they receive in taxes and other revenue. And to make up the difference, needs to continue to borrow. That's right, you guessed it right. Let's find out what our guests think. Martin Safe rejoins us. He's a former managing editor at International Affairs, also a former chief news analyst at United Press International. All right, Martin Safe, welcome back to Economic Divide. When you take a look at how the U.S. national debt has increased multiple times over the, obviously, years and decades, really, the most recent one, $31.4 trillion, December 2021 or January 2022. Hasn't the U.S. debt reached a point, the question being that the figure is so high that, you know, can they ever pay it back? I mean, what if it defaults? What would be the impact on the U.S. economy, do you think?
If there is a default, it will be for the first time in U.S. history. It will be devastating to America's credibility in the world. It will probably cause a crash on Wall Street, such as we have not seen in almost a century since 1929. The results would be catastrophic. And it would throw the American economy and American society into chaos. And privately, a lot of Republicans realize this, but publicly they are cowards, and the Republicans are not certain they can defeat him in 2024. So they want to discredit him politically, and they also believe that if there is an economic recession, even if their policies cause it before 2024, they can blame the president and the Democrats as the party in office for that happening. So it's a very risky and irresponsible policy. It is not a national policy. It is not a patriotic policy in U.S. terms, but they wanted to simply get back into power.
All right, thank you for that, Martin Safe. Let's bring back Richard Black, former state senator of Virginia and Republican politician. Richard Black, welcome back to Economic Divide. The U.S. national debt, it has reached such epic proportions. We need to have you put things into perspective for us, because on the one hand, you have not only economists, but also more importantly, you have some army officials saying that that's the biggest threat to U.S. national security. At the same time, you have the U.S. that spends so much on its military, more than the next nine top spending countries combined. Can you please put that into perspective for us?
Yes, the United States military budget is gargantuan. We have a budget that is 12 times as much as Russia's military budget. Right now, the U.S. spends three times as much as China. Our military presence across the globe is clearly excessive. What are we doing in the Middle East? Why do we have troops in the Middle East? We didn't have that when I was a colonel in the Pentagon. Things were very calm and peaceful over there, and since then, we've had enormous military engagements there.
If lawmakers don't raise the nation's borrowing limit by June, the federal government runs the risk of defaulting on its debt obligation. That would be catastrophic for the economy, which would put millions of jobs in jeopardy. Investors are demanding historically high yields for U.S. Treasury notes that mature in July. That is when the U.S. will default on its debt if no legislative action is taken.
When yields on shorter-term bonds exceed those of longer-term bonds, it's often a sign that bad economic times are ahead.
On one hand, it looks like the Fed can continue raising rates, or at least raise 25 bips in May, which is what the market is expecting, and that's where the consensus view is. On the other hand, of course, we have this banking crisis, which is causing stress in the financial system, and we are seeing signals that credit may be tightening. So I think what is most likely to happen is that the Fed is going to raise this 25 bips, because that's also what they have been communicating for a while indirectly. And then they're likely to pause and see how the inflation evolves, and whether we get the kind of decline in inflation that is expected, that the Fed is expecting. I think the big disconnect right now in the market is that how long the Fed stays at current levels and how soon they are going to cut interest rates. And I think to that extent, what the Fed is saying, that no cuts in 2023 and stay at current high levels. Where
the last prolonged standoff over the debt limit in 2011 led to a downgrade of the U.S. credit rating, which shook financial markets and raised borrowing costs. Some Republicans say the current bill does not do enough to cut the deficit. In 2011, a debt ceiling standoff led to credit rating agency Standard & Poor's downgrade of U.S. debt from the highest possible status, AAA, to AA+. During the last fiscal year, the federal government spent more on interest payments than transportation, housing, or food, and nutrition services combined. In the final quarter of 2022, paid a record $213 billion in interest, up from $63 billion during the same period from the year before. It now seems that the U.S. debt has reached a point that it can never pay it back. About 75% of it is owned either by domestic or foreign investors, including foreign nations. An actual default would be much worse. Not only would the U.S. likely be downgraded again, but government workers and Social Security recipients, among many others, would go unpaid.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apposyan. Surpassing the debt ceiling is another way of saying I have spent too much, and hence, I need more money. As careless as that may sound, the U.S. has time and again breached its debt limit. And here are some more facts on the repercussions. A downgrade by credit rating agencies is not far off the mark, something that has happened before. This incurs increased borrowing costs for businesses and homeowners. Consumer confidence gets impacted, which could lead the economy into recession.
A default on our debt would produce an economic and financial catastrophe. Many of your residents could ultimately lose their jobs. Household payments on mortgages, auto loans, and credit cards would rise, and American businesses would see credit markets deteriorate.
Goldman Sachs has a more dire prediction of what would happen if the debt limit is breached. It said it would halt about one-tenth of U.S. economic activity. If that happened, this would cause the loss of 3 million jobs. Then comes the impact on interest rates, which would be catastrophic, raising the national debt by $850 billion. This would divert taxpayer money away from things like infrastructure, education, and healthcare. Our final question would be, could breaching the U.S. debt ceiling bring down other markets? First, the U.S. dollar standing would take a severe hit, impacting global financial markets. The creditworthiness of U.S. Treasury securities has long bolstered demand for U.S. dollars, contributing to their value and status as the world's reserve currency. Any hit to confidence in the U.S. economy, whether from default or the uncertainty surrounding it, would cause